Ladies and gentlemen, Gregory Peck.
The world never seems as fresh and wonderful, as comforting and terrifying, as good and evil, as it does when seen through the eyes of a child. For a writer to capture that feeling is remarkable. One book, in the last few years, has been so warmly embraced by tens of millions of people. To Kill a Mockingbird, winner of the Pulitzer Prize, just about every other award a book can win.
Gregory Peck, in the original trailer for the film version of To Kill a Mockingbird, Peck played lawyer Atticus Finch. A literary hero, Finch is now more complicated. Harper Lee's sequel, Go Set a Watchman, came out today, and it portrays Atticus as a racist. We'll talk about that later on. But first, we're going to talk about the repercussions of the nuclear deal between the U.S. and Iran. Here's President Obama making the announcement earlier today.
Today, after 2 years of negotiations, the United States, together with our international partners, has achieved something that decades of animosity has not: a comprehensive, long-term deal with Iran that will prevent it from obtaining a nuclear weapon.
There's been strong reaction both for and against the deal. It still needs to be ratified by Congress. Here in L.A. is the largest concentration of Iranians outside that country. And here to tell us more about some of their thoughts and feelings is Iranian-American Sam Yebri. He's an attorney and president of 30 Years After. That's an Iranian-American Jewish civic organization. Welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, I'm sure there are lots of different reactions, broad reactions within the Iranian-American community to the negotiations and to the deal. What are you hearing?
Well, I think as a starting point, for most of us Iranian-Americans, the negotiations presented a welcome glimmer of hope that after 30 years of enmity between Iran and the United States, a hope that diplomacy would be able to prevent a military conflict, a hope that the West could use its extraordinary leverage to improve the lives of Iranians, and a hope that perhaps Iran was truly prepared to change its ways. I think having followed these negotiations over the last 2 years and now reviewing the deal as announced today, many Iranian Americans feel a sense of deep concern about what this deal means, as well as a sense of disappointment.
Disappointment in what way?
Well, this deal has been characterized as a comprehensive deal. Although it's focusing on the nuclear deal, it really does not touch on many issues that Iranian Americans really care about, which is the way that Iran continues to mistreat its own people, the way it persecutes women and gays and journalists and dissidents and religious minorities. Three Iranian Americans are being held hostage by the regime, and it's not really part of any part of these negotiations. And the regime continues to export its terrorism and finance terrorism around the world. So for us Iranian Americans, we were hopeful that these negotiations would lead to demands that the Iranian government change its behavior, that it become a responsible actor. But the contours of this deal are much more narrow. And there's a sense that so much more could have been accomplished, both for Iranians, but also for American interests for generations to come.
Yeah. Well, I suppose the hope is, at least, that with some opening to the United States, some thawing of these hostilities, that that kind of autocratic hand in Tehran might start to loosen.
Well, that hope is really belied by the actions and the statements of the regime over the last few days. President Rouhani himself was marching in a demonstration on Friday in which people were stomping and burning the American flag and chanting death to America. The statements coming from the top, from Khamenei himself, make it clear the regime has no interest in changing its antagonistic views toward the West or America. In fact, this regime, we as Iranian Americans truly understand this regime. It's a theocracy that with a theology that is based on antagonism towards the West. So it's not in its own interest to change its ways, either towards its own people or towards the West. So it really does seem like this hope that is a core, the core benefit of this deal is a false one. It is belied by the statements and the actions of the regime with which we are negotiating.
What about the lifting of sanctions and how that might improve the lives of ordinary Iranians?
Well, It's important to note that there is this hope and there is a belief that, that these sanctions, if implemented, if lifted and implemented in a meaningful way, could trickle down and improve the lives of Iranians. And that's certainly the hope of all Iranian Americans, is that the difficulties that Iranians may have been suffering as a result of these sanctions would improve. But there is a fear that the Revolutionary Guards, which control the Iranian government, won't let that happen, and that these sanctions truly will only benefit the regime and those in power. And if you look at some of the specifics, the arms embargo being lifted, with ballistics missiles potentially being sold to Iran within 8 years, that's deeply troubling, and certainly has no benefit for the average Iranian in Tehran.
Right, and in fact, I think that's what Benjamin Netanyahu was referring to when he said this about the deal.
The world is a much more dangerous place today than it was yesterday. The leading international powers have bet our collective future on a deal with the foremost sponsor of international terrorism.
Okay, so I wonder if from a Jewish perspective and an Israeli perspective, how you and how other Jewish Iranians view this deal.
Well, I mean, I think first, as an American, we understand and we look at this deal. I have two small children myself, and the test that we should all use to analyze this deal is whether it will keep our children and our grandchildren safe for generations to come, but by preventing, truly, as the president said, Iran's path to nuclear weapons. And that's the first test. And I did mention, as Iranian, there's a hope that it would improve the lives of those oppressed Iranians living in Iran. As someone who's Jewish and who understands that this regime is the leading denier of the Holocaust, leading funder of terrorist organizations threatening Jews, and including those in Israel, like Hezbollah and Hamas, there's a deep, deep fear that the upwards of $150 billion in sanctions relief and the transfer of unfrozen assets to Iran would be used not to benefit the average Iranian in Tehran, but will be used to enhance and increase Iran's terrorist activities worldwide, including those against Jews and against Israel.
Okay, so you're obviously concerned, deeply concerned about this deal, but you must know people here who are more supportive. What do they say?
The Iranian American community is a large one, as you mentioned, in Southern California. We're certainly not homogeneous. We have broad perspectives. Some are hopeful this deal will lead to an opening between our two countries, and there's a hope that people in Iran will benefit from the sanctions relief. There are some Iranian Americans who are eager to do business with Iran, and that colors their perspectives. I think those of us who have suffered at the hands of this Islamic Republic, those of us who know people who were jailed because of their religion or because of their political beliefs or because they were gay or because they were suspected of infidelity as a woman, we do not believe this regime can be trusted, and that really gives us a perspective and gives us a real sense of realism towards this deal and not starry-eyed optimism.
Sam Yebri, attorney and president of 30 Years After. It's an Iranian-American Jewish civic organization. Thanks for joining us.
It was a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Well, we'd like to hear from you. Do you have thoughts about the deal with Iran? Is this the best deal we could get? Should, as Sam said, should it have more? Should the U.S. have pressed for more concessions, human rights concessions? You can reach out to us on Facebook or on Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Well, you may have heard rumblings about the earthquake story published in The New Yorker this week. It's titled The Really Big One, and it's a meticulous and, frankly, terrifying piece of science journalism about a quake that could eat Seattle, Portland, and basically the entire Pacific Northwest. People are freaking out. In the words of a FEMA director quoted in the story, everything west of Interstate 5 will be toast. Well, Lucy Jones is here now. She's LA's earthquake czar and says that one fact might not be totally accurate. But for the most part, she says the science in the story checks out. Hi, Lucy.
Hi, good to be here.
Okay, so this concerns the Cascadia subduction zone, which we don't hear a lot about. We hear a lot about the San Andreas Fault. What is the Cascadia subduction zone?
Well, we don't hear about it because it's north of us. It is a subduction zone is one of the three big types of plate tectonic interaction. It's where one plate goes under the other. And it's the type of fault that produces the biggest earthquakes in the world. The great 9.5 Chilean earthquake in 1960, or the great Japanese earthquake, the 9 that happened 4 years ago, are all on subduction zones. It's part of plate tectonics theory. We figured this out in the 70s, that there was a subduction zone off of the Pacific Northwest. It starts at Cape Mendocino and goes up to Vancouver Island. So it's Northern California, Oregon, Washington, and the southernmost part of Canada.
Okay, so she writes, Catherine Schultz, in this article, and she wasn't available to join us because I believe she's on vacation in Oregon. So let's hope the quake doesn't hit while she's on vacation. And she says that in that zone from Mendocino up to Vancouver, she says that if the really big one hits, the coast, that part of the continent, the edge of the continent, will basically drop 6 feet in mere minutes. And some of that will happen under the ocean, which will then cause a massive tsunami, a wall of ocean, basically, that could be as high as 100 feet and would mean 13,000 people perish instantly. Is that an accurate description?
Well, everything up to how many people die is a statement of geology that I can confirm. I don't know about what modeling's been done about how many people will die.
She quotes FEMA as saying that that's their modeling.
Okay. Well, the thing about this earthquake, it will be bigger. And one of the implications, you know, she sort of goes, oh, it's a magnitude 9, and San Andreas only has a magnitude 8. That doesn't mean it will be more shaking, because that 9 is the fault is offshore, which is why it produces a tsunami, which is very deadly. But it means that nobody's right next to the fault. So the shaking that will be received to the cities of Seattle and Portland is less than San Bernardino will be getting in the San Andreas earthquake, because San Bernardino is right on the San Andreas fault. And so it's the implication that a 9 is much worse shaking than an 8 is actually not true. That said, Seattle and Oregon do not have the history of earthquakes that has led California to enact very strict building codes. And the strict building codes really only came into the Pacific Northwest in the 90s, after we realized not just that there was a subduction zone, but we were able to prove that it really did have big earthquakes.
Yeah, and she writes in the article that most of the buildings in Oregon are not earthquake-proof at all.
That's correct. We don't have earthquake-proof buildings. Let's remember that. Our building code is trying to make sure that we can crawl out alive. It is not trying to make our buildings earthquake-proof. So we need to not feel too smug about that. The other side of it, they haven't even tried for the life safety issues. So the worst type of buildings are what the engineers called unreinforced masonry. These are brick buildings that are where the brick's holding up the roof. Brick, the mortar dissolves in earthquakes. They come down. The roof comes down. You kill a lot of people. We haven't allowed those to be built in California since 1935. I think they've only very recently, if at all, banned their construction in Oregon.
And is this because they weren't really aware of this Cascadia subduction zone?
Well, right. I mean, you have to have plate tectonics to even have the model that lets you say that it's there. It's all underwater, right? You don't see anything. Plate tectonics showed us how to interpret the volcanoes that start right at Mount Shasta. That's the volcanoes show you where the subduction zone is, because as the plate goes down under so the ocean comes down under North America, the friction melts the rock and creates the volcanoes. So all of the Cascades are the symbol of that. But we couldn't interpret that until we had the plate tectonic model. And then as we're trying to understand the plate tectonic model, we go, well, but there aren't any earthquakes here. So maybe this isn't what we said, an aseismic subduction zone. And there were some seismologic studies in the 80s that went, that doesn't make sense. This is much more likely to be really big earthquakes. And then the confirming part was the USGS geologist Brian Atwater and his work at the what are called ghost forests, and being able to prove how the coast had dropped before put forests underwater, and so we had a fossil record of the previous earthquakes.
Okay. I think a lot of people want to know exactly what the likelihood of this apocalyptic scenario is. And she writes, or she doesn't create the headline, but the headline says, the really big one, an earthquake will destroy a sizable portion of the coastal Northwest. The question is when. So that is the big question, when.
Well, when, and also destroy is a very strong word that is not obvious from the geology. As I said, the shaking in these earthquakes is not as bad as near San Andreas. We have a way of measuring the intensity of shaking. It's called, there's a modified Mercalli intensity scale. We had intensity 9 in much of the valley for Northridge.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in this earthquake, a much larger area is going to be affected, all the way from Northern California to Canada, but probably the maximum intensity is going to be 8, with just a few pockets of 9 on the coast. So I think destroy is no, that's the part that I'm quibbling at. We've seen these subduction zones in other countries, and the shaking just isn't as strong as when you're right near a magnitude 8.
Well, I think she's talking mainly from the tsunami.
Right, and then you have to look at elevation. 100 feet sounds like a really big wave, but it means once you are above 100 feet elevation, you don't have a problem. So it doesn't extend, you know, that, you know, quote, everything west of I-5 is toast. That's not true. In many places, I-5 is several hundred feet above sea level, and the, you know, the wave may only make it a few blocks inland. So if you live right on the coast, yes. And there are some communities like Seaside, Oregon, or Long Beach, Oregon, where they not only are too low elevation, they don't have a road out. But that's far different from destroying all of the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah. But as you say, if they don't have a road out, there doesn't seem to be
Right. The solution is actually what's called vertical evacuation. And Oregon is undertaking an effort, and I think it's in Seaside, but one of these communities, of building a 10-story building so that you can run up to the 10th floor after the shaking.
It's still there.
Well, it probably will be. You build it. It's easy to build a building to withstand intensity 9 shaking. Lots of buildings are still standing in the valley after Northridge. And you know you want to do it. You just build it stronger. And you can have a building that will stand up, and you know to run up. So it's actually, it's far better. It's a real solution that will save a lot of people.
Do you think it's a good idea to print these kinds of articles and get people really scared?
How long are they going to be scared, right? We're going to have a freak out for 2 days. If it just gets them scared and they put their head in the sand and nothing happens about it, no, we didn't do any good. But if it could actually say, okay, you've got a real problem, whether you want to be scared about it or not, you've got a real problem. And the only thing standing between you and life after that earthquake is investing some money now. And getting people to invest money for a disaster that's far out, often being scared doesn't do that. What you need to do, and what I would have liked to have seen more of in the article, is not just, yes, it's really bad, but yes, there are real solutions. You know, they made a point of saying there's no early warning system. They didn't say the USGS is actually developing a prototype and is working with the University of Washington right now, and the only thing standing between the Pacific Northwest and an early warning system is a decision to spend $16 million a year on behalf of Congress. And so let's look at what the solutions are, because, in fact, the earthquake is inevitable, but the disaster is not. And we can make choices about this.
Lucy, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
That's Lucy Jones. She is LA's earthquake czar, pretty much, and a seismologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. And we'd like to hear from you. Did you read that article? And what did you think? You can see it, if you haven't read it yet, at thenewyorker.com. Is this an article that people are talking about? Do you know friends in Portland and Seattle who are now considering fleeing? Let us know at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up on the program, Harper Lee's novel Ghosts at a Watchman is out today. We'll speak with her biographer, who says this book changes the way we understand To Kill a Mockingbird. That story is next on Press Play.
take KCRW with you on one of our mobile apps. Available for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry devices. Stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and our News 24 and Eclectic 24 streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
The defendant is not guilty. But somebody in this courtroom is. Now, gentlemen, in this country, our courts are the great levelers. In our courts, all men are created equal.
Gregory Peck as attorney Atticus Finch in the film version of To Kill a Mockingbird. For more than half a century, Atticus Finch has been a model of integrity and tolerance for millions of readers. Well, now that has changed. Ghost at a Watchman, Harper Lee's sequel to the novel To Kill a Mockingbird, was published today. In it, Atticus has turned into a racist. For more on this and the strange story of how Ghost at a Watchman came to be, I'm joined by Charles Shields. He's a biographer and the author of Mockingbird, A Portrait of Harper Lee. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you've read Ghost at a Watchman, and tell me your reaction to it.
Well, had it not been from the pen of Harper Lee, I seriously doubt whether it would have been published. It needs some pretty heavy editing. On the other hand, I'm so glad to see this book come along this summer, because as the Confederate flag is coming down and we're revisiting issues of our past, of the Civil War, of slavery, Southern heritage, it's a perfect time for a book like this. But it's a very upsetting book, too.
From what I understand, she wrote what became Ghost at a Watchman, and then her editor said, why don't you focus on the younger scout? And that's what became To Kill a Mockingbird.
Exactly. And that's what accounts for the big difference in the two Atticuses. In To Kill a Mockingbird, we're seeing Atticus Finch from the perspective of a 9-year-old girl who adores her father. And her father is a civic leader, much looked up to. He's a very good attorney, and he's an excellent single dad. And in Ghost at a Watchman, she is now 26 years old. She's been in New York for 5 years. She comes back to Alabama, and she sees what it is, a hotbed of racism.
Yeah. Does it make you look at the book and its message differently?
Oh, yeah. It's two different messages. In To Kill a Mockingbird, a standard is set that we can all aspire to. Wouldn't we like to be like Atticus? Or shouldn't we stand up in our communities for what is right? And when we read Ghost at a Watchman, what we're focusing on is an aspect of America that's painful to think about. The racial slurs in the book are very painful to read. They're ugly. There's parts of the book that are just downright vulgar. But that's the way people talked.
Can you give us some example of how Atticus is different in this book?
Let's see. Let me start with the similarities. It's easier to go from there. He's humorous. He is tolerant. He's a much respected person. How is he different? He's worried. He's worried about the South changing. He wants to preserve the status quo. He's not a crusader for racial justice. He is a crusader for the Southern way of life. And it's the old states' rights, lost cause, Southern way of life, Southern heritage argument all over again. And the narrator is shocked when Calpurnia, her housekeeper, looks at her with a very frank expression. And suddenly, to her shock, Jean-Louise Finch realizes that black people see themselves as different and oppressed by whites.
Can you talk a little bit about how this book came to be published? Because is it of your opinion that Harper Lee wanted this book to be published or not?
She says she wanted it to be published, and I'm just going by the lady's word. The person who did not want it published was her elder sister, Alice. Alice, who passed away in November at 103, never wanted this book published. It's unflattering to their father. It's upsetting. It doesn't put the narrator in a very good light. She seems very conflicted about being female. There's a lot of contemptuous remarks about marriage between men and women, sexuality, babies. There's quite a bit of conflict under the surface going on in this book.
Hmm. What is your understanding about Harper Lee's sexuality?
Well, you know, I never commented on that when I was talking strictly about To Kill a Mockingbird, because it had no relevance to that novel. I mean, when we're talking about a 9-year-old running around in overalls and climbing trees, what do we care what the author's sexuality is? But I have to tell you, after reading this book and how false the romance is between the narrator and her gentleman friend, how she views women in marriages, and her conviction that she's going to be a spinster for the rest of her life, I think this is 1950s code for I'm gay.
Interesting. Well, Harper Lee never married and never had children.
No, but neither did her sister. You know, Alice didn't either, but I think Alice didn't for another reason. I think it's because the only boy in the family of the four children, Edwin, died very young. And so the sister, Alice, stepped up to the plate and took over the role that her brother would have taken over, which was, you know, going into the law office and owning part of the newspaper, all of the sort of empire that Mr. Lee had laid out for his family, Alice assumed.
So 2 million copies of this book, I understand, were published today. And so I guess this is going to make a lot of money.
There are $46, $40 million probably.
Yeah. Who gets all that money?
I don't know. Publishing contracts are about 14 pages of boilerplate. It's an arcane business. And who knows?
Does Harper Lee?
Yeah, she retains the copyright. Harper Lee already realizes about $500,000 a year from To Kill a Mockingbird.
Earlier you said that, you have only her word to go by when it came to her assent to have this published. But there have been some reports that she is not exactly in full health and that she may not be fully mentally competent right now. She's 89 years old. What do you think about that?
Well, the state of Alabama sent in some people to interview her. But, you know, even the people who interviewed her said, we're not doctors. And they said that, nevertheless, she seems competent. She seems to know what she's about. I wonder why they didn't have her, examined by people who are experts on elder care, that sort of thing. But, you know, I'm not an attorney. I'm a literary biographer. So I just have to take it on faith that she wanted this book to come to market. But it could never have come to market in the 1950s. It's just too rough.
So we heard yesterday that there might be a third novel.
Yes.
What do you think about that?
Well, Ghost at a Watchman was complete when To Kill a Mockingbird came out and became very, very popular. And her agent, Annie Laurie Williams, sent her a kind of a teasing note that said, could the Mockingbird have a little brother or sister soon? Meaning she wanted to capitalize on the success of To Kill a Mockingbird. But, you know, Ghost at a Watchman was already finished, so why didn't they turn their attention to that book? I think a Shaggy Dog story is developing here about lost manuscripts and intentions and things like that.
Well, are you happy that you read Ghost at a Watchman, and do you recommend it?
I recommend it because I think it's an eye-opener. I think that its literary merit is not there, but I think as a contribution to culture and the national conversation about racism and who we are, I think it's invaluable.
Charles Shields, biographer and author of Mockingbird, A Portrait of Harper Lee. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up on the program, marketing wizards spitball about how to create the perfect ad campaign to get you to save water. And later, why some local farmers are growing crops that you'd think would take tons of water, tropical fruit.
They're growing papayas, pineapples, bananas. There's other companies that are growing pineapple guavas, dragon fruits, finger limes, passion fruit, and cherimoya.
Those stories after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage on our mobile app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, you might have heard that there's a drought on, and with mandatory conservation for all Californians, politicians and water officials are doing their best to get people to change their behavior and save water.
A message from our state of California. Californians, we are in a historic drought. For the first time ever, California has had to implement mandatory water reductions across the state. This hot, dry summer, we need you to do more to save water. Turn it off. Only water important trees and plants to keep them healthy. And let your lawn fade to gold. Let it go, California Gold.
Okay, so we're wondering now, how smart is the advertising, like that spot, that's trying to get us to be water-wise? So we've asked two communications experts to join us. Sasha Strauss is the founder of the branding company Innovation Protocol. Hi, Sasha.
Hi, wonderful to be with you.
Nice to have you. And Mike Rudin is the creative director and founder of Armed Mind. That's a creative agency that specializes in the entertainment industry. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Well, both of you are based here in Los Angeles, and when you hear a spot like that, which is a statewide spot, what do you think? Let's start with you, Mike.
You know, it's hard to work on a spot like that because there are so many different parties. There's a lot of goals. There's a lot of stakeholders in the room. But when you listen to something like that, it's a little promo-y, and it almost sounds like something promoting a water park versus a water drought. And that's what worries me a little bit. Like, does it really engage?
Like, where's the urgency?
Yeah, where's the urgency in the sense of emotion, and how's that going to rally someone to make a change?
And Sasha, what about the line, "Let it go golden rather than brown"?
Right. It's all by design. I think that's what's important about this conversation, is that we're seeing that the cause is valid, but if we just hit people with the abrupt details, they might not quite get it. Whereas if we package it in words and forms that they can understand, they can get actually excited about having a golden lawn.
Yeah. Well, you know, here's the thing. Do you use the carrot or do you use the stick? So in that particular instance, I guess it's more gentle persuasion rather than we're all doomed and going to die.
No fear mongering there. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, do you think that that's effective?
It seems like a stage one kind of move. You know, right now, fear-mongering probably isn't the first stage for this. They're probably holding on to that until it's more dire, and they don't need to do that quite yet.
Although one would think it is pretty dire at this point.
Exactly, which is probably why the results aren't where they want them to be quite yet.
Yeah. So, Sasha, what do you think? I mean, are there better ways of getting the message across than that?
Absolutely. And I think that the fear-mongering is an example of the type of information, but also these gentle campaigns that are silly are another type. And I think that we need a communication system. There's what we teach our kids, or what we learn in Boy Scouts, or how we as soccer players learn about the field. There's little intricate moments where we can imbue this understanding. And that's what I think needs to happen. I think Mike's comment is right. This is just one method. There's the death, doom, and destruction method. But often when you incite such fear, all you cause people to do is stop listening. They don't get it. They just turn it off. And so I think that's why this campaign seems so gentle. It's like, listen, we're not trying to be obtrusive, but please pay attention to this idea.
Yeah. And then there's also Mayor Garcetti's own campaign. It features a very friendly looking drop of water called Save the Drop. I mean, it is really cuddly, and I think there should be plush toys made from it, but
for the water park. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
No, the problem with the Save the Drop icon is it's a character, but it doesn't create that sense of urgency until maybe the drop evaporates and goes up into the clouds and dies. You don't really feel as though there's something dire happening. It's kind of like a infographical, almost Saturday morning cartoon approach to something that is a little bit more grave.
So, Sasha, do you think that the drop should die?
Oh, no. I actually think that it's causing conversation, and that's the best type of communication campaign. I tell you, it's not the first time people are hearing about it. They're like, oh, this is about that drought thing again. Now I understand why I have to take steps 7, 8, and 9.
It's one of those things where you're talking about shared understanding, but right now, in terms of the potential of this campaign, it might lie in crowdsourcing ideas on how to save water and people talking about what they're doing in their own individual lives. It's actually a lot of information rollout from the top down, and it's not really from the community talking to each other. And so if you just look at the hashtag right now, it isn't necessarily trending. It's more like an info repository. And where it could really blossom and catch like wildfire is people challenging one another, people sharing tools that they've done and innovated in their own homes. And that's where this stuff really starts to spread.
So what you're talking about is Mayor Garcetti's plan or this campaign from the mayor's office that has you hashtag your ideas and under the hashtag Save the Drop, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying that's just not really working.
Well, right now, at a very cursory glance online, there was like one or two vines and maybe a tweet every 3 days. And that's not, I don't think, where they want to be.
Okay, so how do we get them where they want to be? Let's use your creative minds now.
Well, there's a lot of different ways of going at this. Like Sasha mentioned, from a creative standpoint, you need a communication platform for all this. But in terms of just that side of it, really crowdsourcing ideas, establish tiers and milestones and challenge people to reach those and reward them once they get there. There's no kind of system in place to do that. Right now, a lot of how these sites are set up is kind of a utilitarian list of things to do in your house. But there's no motivation or rewards or any kind of mini milestones that people can do. And so that list can be kind of exhausting. So if you did almost like hackathons or sprints, you know, see what you can do in this one day or a week, how much can you save, and set up little challenges that can gain momentum. And then that huge list can start getting crossed off.
So not necessarily lowering your water bill, but other things.
Yeah. Take it down into one aspect, you know, turn off the faucet when you're brushing your teeth instead of the laundry list of all the different things you can do.
Right. And so, Sasha, what about the actual messaging? Do you think that that's working?
Yeah. And funny, I'll relate back to my coworkers. They were talking about some of the messages that were sticking, that their friends were talking about. And there was a really funny conversation. Someone said, all right, well, listen, who are we talking to? All right, we're talking to people in California. Those people are individuals who know thyself and are focused on themselves. And so, for example, they're diet focused. Is there such thing as the, like, SoCal drought diet where you splurge on water-friendly produce like lettuce and kale and broccoli, but you sort of scale back on, like, you know, beef and almonds or something, where when people are asking you why you're making your food choices, the answer is that you're doing the drought diet, but it also becomes like a socialite behavior, like something that people talk about. We need little things like that across all different types of audience members so that everybody sort of gets to participate and contribute.
What about getting celebrities involved?
If you look at how ALS Challenge kind of took off, that was kind of galvanized by a couple athletes at the beginning challenging each other, and those guys have huge install bases. And so you always have to be careful with spokespeople, and you want to make sure that it's an authentic connection to the whatever the movement is. But there's a huge level of credibility that kicks in when you have the right influencers and the right spokespeople, and it's not just the politicians doing the talking, because the politicians do so much other talking that occasionally a message like this one can get lost in all the others.
Yeah, Mike, he's so right. I mean, celebrities are a catalyst. They're a good way to get people to pay immediate attention. But in the end, like Mike said, do they effectively represent the cause? I think that there's a better phrase rather than celebrity. How about celebrated lives? So individuals who are living in ways that we would like to celebrate. And some of them we make fun of. Some of them we stand in awe of. But in the end, you know, if you look at Instagram or any trending channel, the content that people are following, the individuals that they're following, are not necessarily Hollywood starlets, celebrities. They are celebrated lives worth witnessing.
Like a cat. That's what we need. We need a grumpy cat for the drought.
Well, listen, cats drinking, what could be cuter?
By the way, I really like the drought diet idea. And it brought to mind another one that, like, if you're a restaurant and you want to support this cause, what about pouring less than a full glass of water or drawing a line on the cup? Have every consumer recognize that there's a drought. Don't give ice and charge a dollar for a donation for ice because we're in a drought. There are ways that local businesses and local communities can get behind this. So it's not just, you know, politicians and influencers, but it feels like there are touch points, you know, in your daily life when you go to a restaurant, a grocery store, when you're home, when you're online.
Okay, so let's say the water agencies decided to hire both you guys. If you came in to their, you know, spitballing meeting, what would you say?
Sasha, I think, you know, we'd come in there together, first of all. We're a pretty good team.
Right.
No,
we're good.
I think that where there could be a very powerful message here is to take the camera off of water and apply it to something else that would connect in a more urgent and emotional way. So, for example, if we're talking about the water shortage situation and we pivot it and we take the exact same argument, the same situation, and we talk about food shortage, oxygen shortage, medicine shortage, your eyes start opening and you feel urgent. And because water flows out of our faucets, because it's at the store and it's still not that expensive, there is an urgency. But if we applied that message to something that can hit a little bit more deeply as like a metaphor in a lot of ways, I think that would be some stark key art. Those messages would really disrupt enough to provide change.
And what do you think, Sasha? What would you, if you came into this meeting, what would be your main point that you'd want to get across?
Okay. I give in. So it sounds like we need a death, doom, and destruction sort of version of this. And so I'll give you this. How about rolling blue outs? that, you know, maybe it's 10 seconds, but it's like, just like Mike said, it's that little trigger, like a half-filled glass of water, which says, hey, like, hey, everybody, you know, pay attention to this because it matters that much.
So I'm wondering, though, are we expecting too much from you guys, from advertising, to get people to change their behavior? This blue out thing, that goes beyond, right? That goes beyond advertising.
Well, if you show gruesome advertisements on television, is that better? Like, is that more understandable? I think, you know, advertising is designed to just get people's attention. It's like snapping your fingers. It's like, hey, pay attention to this. Now, there has to be the subsequent follow-up. There has to be the deeper explanation, whether that's with hashtags and social content or marketing brochures or anything that would sort of bring the deeper awareness, reaching out to religious organizations so that all the priests and leaders and rabbis are communicating, hey, everybody, by the way, at the end of the sermon here, 5 seconds on, don't forget about the drought and please participate. Those types of granular behaviors start to compound and inform. And I think that if we use advertising as, all right, let's clap our hands so everybody hears us. Okay, good. Now they're listening. Now what? Now what, school system? Now what, business sector? That's the next question.
Yeah. Well, I think everyone now is pretty well aware that we're in a drought, and yet the behavior hasn't really caught up to that. And so where do you see yourselves as linking those two?
I think there's a lack of urgency, even though we all know how dire it is. Some mix of the frequency of the communication, who is giving the communication, and the creative itself isn't creating urgency. And I think that's what both Sasha and I are talking about from our ideas is creating that emotional connection to the problem and then an urgent desire to fix it. And I love the idea of sermons and what if there was a shortage on holy water itself? You know, like get in there and make it intimate to whatever situation it is, get that emotional connection, and then you might get that urgent response.
So that cuddly little drop of water is just not doing it? Save the drop?
Not alone,
yeah.
It just cannot answer the question by itself. It is a part of a communication system. I remember I went to school in Southern California growing up, and in third grade, my teacher came to me and said, hey, Sasha, we're all doing a little project. What type of project do you want to work on? And I was hearing at the time a little bit about a drought, and I was like, what does that mean? How can I help? And she said, well, why don't you make signs for every single classroom? I was in third grade. I was just barely getting by. And ultimately, I created this silly little pity. I think it said something like, don't be a dip, don't let the water drip. That was my third year.
That's
grade
really
vocabulary.
Good, actually.
Thanks. And I tell you, I've been conserving water since the third grade. It has been top of mind since that little ask of my kind third grade teacher. And so we need big campaigns. We need bus shelters and movie theater, you know, slides, yes. But we also need, like in the classroom, the teacher saying, hey, kids, there's something going on and let's think about it. What would you do? And that enough, all those granules together will grow the change.
I like that. Don't be a dip. Don't let the water drip.
What's behind?
Well, thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Such a pleasure, Madeline. Thank you for the time.
Sasha Strauss, founder of the branding company Innovation Protocol, and Mike Rudin is the creative director and founder of the agency Armed Mind. Here's another one. Don't be lonely. Listen to Warren Olney.
Isn't that cute?
Hi there.
Yeah, that's good advice and counsel.
So what will we hear if we listen to you?
What we're going to hear is a very, very comprehensive conversation about the Iran nuclear deal. And the headline on it is, the deal is done, but the battle is just beginning, which I think everybody knew. Mm-hmm. But it's really on in full force. And it's very interesting, very important. And the basic bottom line for one of our guests is, what else is there now? The negotiating is over, and all you got is this deal. It's either this or not.
So it's thumbs up, thumbs down for Congress?
You got it.
And do we know what they'll do?
We don't know. It's likely they probably won't pass it. It's likely they probably won't approve it, but they may not be able to get the 2/3 majority needed to override a presidential veto.
A promised veto. All right. Thank you, Warren Olney. Don't be lonely. Listen at 1 o'clock. Thank you. And coming up on this program, why some local farmers are trying to grow tropical fruit, crops that naturally grow in very wet conditions. We'll have that story next on Press Play.
Immerse yourself in Rhythm Planet, hosted by Tom Schnabel, the world music blog and podcast dedicated to history, storytelling, and, of course, the music. Check it out now at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Mangoes, papayas, bananas, tropical fruits like these come from tropical climates, right? Well, a small group of Southern California farmers is trying to change that. They're growing crops never thought possible in the continental United States. Catherine Spires is food editor at KCT. She's here to tell us more about this strange phenomenon, strange fruit. Hi. These farmers are around the Santa Barbara area?
Yeah, they're all in Santa Barbara County. And the fun thing about Santa Barbara County is all the very different microclimates that they have up there. So there's room to experiment with doing all kinds of crops in that county. So a few years ago, a company called Good Land Organics, they're a farm, they partnered with the University of California to try and see if coffee might be grown in the continental U.S.
Coffee?
Yeah, and this was crazy talk at the time when they started, because it is generally accepted that you cannot grow coffee outside of the tropics, which is the area between the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn. But they're actually having some success with it. So that kind of kicked off this new era of experimentation.
And how are they doing this?
So the area that Goodland Organics in particular is in this sort of area that gets hot during the day, but a muggy heat, which we don't normally see in California. It's more of a tropical heat. And they never get very cold. They never go through frost, and you can't have frost on tropical fruit. So they sort of thought about the actual ecology of the area and thought, oh, you know, this might actually work.
And is that because the climate is changing?
Not necessarily. I think they just hadn't thought of it before until this stroke of genius happened upon them like 10 years ago. And it's been a slow process. But as other companies have seen their success, they have thought, oh, maybe we can start growing tropical or subtropical fruit in the area as well.
So what are they growing?
Well, in particular, there's a company called Golden State Papayas, and they're growing papayas, pineapples, bananas. There's other companies that are growing pineapple guavas, dragon fruits, finger limes, passion fruit, and cherimoya. There's a lot going on up there right now.
Wow. And do they have to do anything like use special pesticides or anything like that?
No special pesticides. However, with the cherimoyas, I think this is so great. There aren't any natural or native cherimoya pollinators in California. So they're actually hand pollinating all of the fruit with paintbrushes every day during the season.
Every day?
Yes. So there's a reason why local tropical fruit is so expensive.
Oh my gosh.
It's pretty labor intensive.
Really labor intensive.
Yeah.
I've never had a cherimoya, I don't think.
Oh, you should. You can get them at farmers markets now. They're sort of, they look a little bit like a light-skinned avocado, but you cut it open and it's this custardy inside. Mm. And you can just scoop it up and eat it out of hand. They're great.
Mm. Well, is anyone saying that this is a bad idea, that we shouldn't be doing this?
I'm sure there are some people who don't like the idea. Again, with the cherimoyas, sometime in, I believe, the 70s, there was this big cherimoya death. And so what one of the farmers did is started crossbreeding them. Some people who are strict about the whole GMO thing would say that makes them GMO fruit. Of course, it was done all naturally, and it's just a hybrid. But I think people are mostly into it, at least from the consumer level, because now you can get locally grown bananas. I mean, you're saving on environmental costs. It's pretty amazing.
But it's not a lot. I mean, it's not agribusiness, right? I mean, most of our tropical fruit, our bananas, are grown on huge corporate farms.
Yeah, that's right. I don't think that Santa Barbara tropical fruit is ever going to find a place, you know, in grocery stores or supermarkets. A lot of them do wholesale, and they're selling to really upscale restaurants in Southern California, but around the country as well. So that could be where the bulk of their business is, but they're getting great attention at farmers markets. Because, you know, people who go to farmers markets are always interested in new developments in local food.
Right.
So, yeah, like Goodland sells their coffee, Golden State Papayas, people are going absolutely nuts for them at the Santa Monica farmers market.
And do you think that they could grow tropical fruits indoors in greenhouses?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Some of them are utilizing greenhouses just to control it a little more, control the environment a little more than maybe they would naturally, especially at the beginning stages. They don't know exactly how it's going to go. So if you have your starts in greenhouses, you know, it's a better return on your investment, hypothetically.
Now, the tropics, they have a lot of water. We do not have a lot of water. Is this a problem, growing these fruits in a place that doesn't really have a lot of water?
Well, there's an argument to be made against everything, I suppose. But again, the dew in the mornings, you know, Santa Barbara just has wet mornings. So they're getting a lot of that naturally. And they aren't really, the environment really does match up pretty well. So they aren't really using more waters than other crops, you know, like almonds or anything like that.
Oh, you had to bring up the almond. Poor, poor almond. Catherine Spires, food editor at KCT. Thank you.
Thank you.
And sitting in for Julie Myers, Christian Bordahl is here with the listener feedback.
Hey,
hi there.
Madeline, hi. So we started the show today talking about the Iran nuclear deal.
Yep.
And some of our listeners at least seem to have a kind of jaundiced view. Tony Escasso says Iran's going to do whatever it wants. Take it for granted. They'll have a nuclear device whenever they put the technology together, regardless of treaties. Mark Griffin says the deal is everything Iran wanted and they still get a bomb in 10 years. But Chris Mamian says the Persian Empire is widely considered to be one of the most civil, benevolent empires in world history. Iran has never in its history started a war with another country. Don't believe the war machine propaganda. There you have it. We also talked about branding the drought. What's the best kind of pitch to get people to conserve water? As usual, that brings out strong emotions. But the one person who sent us a nice little post-it said, "Dirty car, clean conscience, I heart California." I like that.
That's a good one. To the point. Well, thank you.
You are so welcome.
Mordahl. Speaking of to the point, it's coming up in a few moments from now. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.